Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Eugene Lim, author of Search History, published just a couple of days ago by Coffee House Press. Eugene is the author of Fog and Car. He's the author of The Strangers, Dear Cyborgs. His latest piece is in The New Yorker. It's part of the summer flash fiction series. It's called What We Have Learned, What We Will Forget, What We Will Not Be Able to Forget. Eugene's work has also appeared in Granta, which I love, many other fine periodicals. He tells us in his own biography on his website that he is a pessimist of the intellect by night, which is kind of like me, except I think he's in the daytime as well. He also says he's the librarian at the Charles Xavier School for the Greatly Responsible, which is not a home for our unusual and challenged X-Men, but it's really Hunter College High, the most acclaimed secondary school in the country. And he also runs Ellipsis Press, which I think you should look at their website and check out their titles because they're really cool. And he has no Wikipedia entry. So anyway, Search History is what is written on the cover, but the actual title of the book is The Adventures, Quests, and Setbacks of Frank Exit, His Friends and Other Strangers of Far-Flung and Nearby Origin, Caught in the Winds of La Hueda, Hacia, Adelante, or The Unfolding, or The Flux. Flux is what it's all about, and exquisite is one of my favorite words. So I could tell you a little bit more of what this book is about, but it's too much work for me to do, so I'll let Eugene do it. So welcome, Eugene, and thanks for theoretically being here.
Thanks for theoretically having me, Sam.
So here's a question. Why do you think one is not a prime number?
Why is one? It's purely by definition.
And that's kind of what, well, here's the way I look at it. And I'm not asking it like superficially or facetiously. It's just that, you know, a prime number is divisible by itself in one. And you're writing, it's like, okay, you're called Eugene, but that's not what you are. You're something else. There's lots of Eugenes. And one is just what something is called. So one is divisible by itself and it's divisible by one. And until like the 1900s, one was considered a prime number. And I asked Frank Wilczek, the Nobel Prize winning physicist who discovered time crystals, I asked him, how come one's not a primary number? And he goes, because it wouldn't be convenient.
Well, his answer is probably much more knowledgeable than what I get. But purely by definition, I think I don't think that's a bad answer, off the cuff answer. And sometimes I think about it in relation to grammar or a lot of things. You know, and dictionaries can be either descriptive or prescriptive, right? They can tell you how you should structure a sentence, or they can describe how language is used. I didn't mean to go in that direction, but maybe you had more to say about the prime number question.
Well, the reason I ask it is because, I mean, there's so much about Borges that's both written in your work and kind of tied to it. And I was talking about the Library of Babel because my background is exactly the opposite. But you talk about the infinite book case, the infinite library, and given the fact that you work in one, do you ever consider Hunter College's library as being infinite in any sense of the word?
Infinite in any sense of the word? Well, I guess any library kind of points to what it could be, points to its potential. I remember first going into a big university library, just thinking how this is a massive intelligence, you know, that it's a big brain almost. I don't know if I feel that about my not puny, but not infinite high school library where I work, but definitely when you're in a big collection, you feel the largeness of its knowledge and how much you will never be able to touch. And it's a little bit different, I think, from the internet, even though I did conflate them, because libraries are in a lot of ways curated, and you can browse them, and what you're browsing is kind of the collective impulse, the impulse to collection of, you know, whoever acquired that collection. The infinite library of the internet or is uncurated. You know, it expands geometrically or exponentially every moment. So there are different orders of magnitude.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I don't like the expression, your character doesn't like the expression of going down the rabbit hole. And then, oh, hold up your book so that we can see what the cover is. It's called Search History, and the cover looks as if I'm doing what, like I was doing researching you. You know, I'm going one place and then I go to another place and then I go to Borges and then I go to all the different people that you use, especially in your epigraphs. And owning a bookstore, as many times as people will say, you can't judge a book by its cover, everyone who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover, which is why it's good that you have such a good cover.
I think all book people would say, you got to judge a book by its book cover. I mean, they know that the outside matters and the object matters. Maybe not all book people, that might be too much. But especially if you work in a library bookstore, I think that you realize that people, that impression matters.
And that's why generally the publishers, now I don't know whether you got a chance to vet it or not, but that's why generally the publishers pick a cover because they want to sell the books.
That is correct. I love the cover. It's by a designer named Michael Salu. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Who's I think in the UK, but I gave them certain ideas or examples that I'd like for them to do. But I've also been on the, because I run a small press, I've been on the other end where the author doesn't like the cover you chose. And so I'm sensitive to that negotiation, but yeah, I'm happy with my book.
And then so am I. I love the cover because—
Thank you.
It goes, you know, it's like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box. You see what's going to happen in the inside to a certain extent. And then the other thing I like as a bookseller is I always look at the dedication. I always look at the epigraphs, and the dedication is to the photographer who actually took the picture of you on your website, right?
Yeah, he passed away. He returned to the original source on November of 2017. And he was a good friend of mine, and that loss, I think, is a driving force, almost the secret engine of the book.
That's interesting. Well, that goes to the fact, too, that so much of the book is kind of driven or pivoted upon the pictures and the interior epigraphs. Yeah, how did you decide that you were going to include so many pictures and that they would be so much like arrows pointing to the subsequent paragraph?
Yeah, the epigraphs and the photographs, I think, are, I don't think you could have gotten away with those pictures and epigraph, perhaps in a pre-internet age, but because they're available and you could like take the phrase, do a Google search on the quote, then you find the context within which they're written, it kind of opens you up to another facet for whatever story is about to be told or some theme of the book. And Sebald is mentioned. You know, Sebald has a couple quotes in there, and he, of course, is a great user and manipulator of photographs. And he uses photographs to kind of hint at the veracity of the history he's telling, but he's manipulated them so it's kind of a double thing where there he's trying to show you history, and he's also showing you how history, especially through fiction, can be artifice and falsified.
And the three main epigraphs at the outset, the one by Cesar, who writes books like that come out every 6 weeks, you know, it's like, yeah. He's prolific.
He's very prolific. That's where that phrase, la vida hacia adelante, comes from. That's his phrase. I've seen various translations, but there escapes forward, or kind of almost, there's almost something foolish, rushing foolishly ahead about that.
Yeah. Yeah, what do they say? They say about him, constant momentum in the fictional narrative. And that's kind of like the New Yorker piece that you just did, you know, that came out in August. That's how I felt. I felt like I was rushing headlong down something, yeah. You know? And then the next one is The Gateless Gate, which, you know, is a Japanese koan, which also reminds me of your literature. But you know, because of my dog, because I always think my dog has somewhat of a Buddha nature. What made you stick that in there? Because it's a good one.
Well, there's a story of the dog that's central to the book, but that koan that is like a lot of the koans is kind of a question about what is your true nature, what is your true self, right? And it's set up. Some of the koans are set up like this way. You have the teacher says to the student, A is true, but this other person says not A is also true. So A or not A, which is it? And if you say A or not A, you're screwed. you pass that particular test or you've failed that particular test. And the teacher generally is trying to bring you or trying to lead you towards some kind of non-dichotomous thinking. But it's about self and it's about the self. And we could talk about that a little bit more, but I liked it because for a lot of reasons, it has the dog in it. And the dog is so crucial, central to the book. But it also kind of points to this, and this is a little bit more subtle, but in my mind, this is what it reflects. We're in this weird moment with artificial intelligence, with AI, where we haven't crossed the Rubicon yet, but we are in the midst of crossing the Rubicon. There is this revolution happening. And it's kind of happening quietly, but enormous things are happening. And I think it brings up ideas of what makes a thinking thing, what makes sentience, what makes consciousness. It brings up all these topics as well. So that's also wrapped, the AI is such a big theme, dogs in a way are a big thing. So that quote from The Gateless Gate kind of hints at both, I think, aspects, for me anyway.
Yeah, and it's funny because, and this is, we're starting to get on the rabbit hole ourselves, but I'm sure you've read what Elon Musk says about AI and what Stephen Hawking said about AI. And then I thought about you putting in that GPT-3 little epigraphy thing and the picture. And so then her name is Sophie, right?
Whose name?
The GPT-3, the woman it's not Sophie, is it? The woman you speak to and you... Maybe she can pass the Turing test, you know, she'll talk to you.
Oh, in real life, not in the book. I don't know the name of which one you're talking about.
But you know that GPT. So GPT-3 is owned by Microsoft now. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know. Did they recently buy OpenAI or something?
Yeah. So it's like classic. And then, you know, it's like, yeah. So while I was reading the book, I'm thinking, I wonder if Eugene thinks that AI is a good thing, a bad thing. Does he think both things? And I really, you know, maybe I just didn't read it enough properly, but I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either. I mean, it's like asking, is the internet a good thing or a bad thing? I think the internet, you know, it's a major transformative technology. I think that's happening. And I was interested in the two questions about AI and the kind of one came from the other, but the GPT-3 and these natural language processing machines, these machines that are fed, or GPT-3 and GPT-2 are fed the internet. And I forget who said it, but some AI scientist was like, and whatever we're saying, you and I now, which is going to end up on the internet, is going to be consumed by the GPT-3's children, right? So right now we are feeding the future AIs, the future machines. So that's something. I'll say this other thing. In that story, in that New Yorker story, there's a line which I was happy to get in there, which is a proposed variation on the Turing test, where the cyborg asks itself questions to determine if it's human. And I think that's what we are doing when we interact with social media, because we are part machine at this point. We're plugged into the internet, we carry around these exobrains of ours all the time. And then we're part machine. And then we look at this network that we've created collectively and go, am I human? Am I still, what does it mean to be human? And so GPT-3, who is fed all of our thoughts, our hopes and dreams, and all the dribble of text that we've written, now we're asking it and it's asking itself, you know, how human am I, or how thinking am I, how sentient am I? I think, so anyways, all that to say, I don't know. I wouldn't want to put kind of a a category. AI is bad, AI is good, but AI is an enormous thing that is creeping up on us. And I think we're largely caught unawares of this revolutionary or transformative moment.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I don't think it's like a spoiler, but you know, the first paragraph of the book, you say who it's written by, and I'm going, oh, I didn't know that. And then also, you also say it's the reader's adventure. And I'm going, okay, is this something? And then I realize you're kind of giving me license to do whatever I want to do as I go through the book by saying that at the beginning. And it's funny because it's like, the second question, like about like one being a prime number, is I've interviewed like four guys recently who, and one woman, sorry, who've written books about human consciousness and where it resides. Mm. And I've asked each of them, what if we live in a solipsistic universe? And all of them have gotten angry at me because that screws up their entire thing. And it also means that only one of us is here now. It doesn't really make any difference what the answer is. If it's yes, I might as well just go home, except I am home. But yeah, so do you ever think about that? I actually think about the possibility that I live in a soul since I'm so narcissistic.
Okay, so there are variations of that question. Do we live in a simulation? Do we live in a solipsistic universe of your own mind? Is it the solipsism of like some kind of deity or God? In Dear Cyborgs, there is a quote about solipsism, actually, that even in solipsism, you can be moral. Even if it's just your mind and you're not sure, or I don't know if it's solipsism, but it's an agnosticism where you're not sure what else exists, you can still choose ethical choices and make ethical choices, right? So that's important. B, I have a kind of mystical understanding or a mystical response to your question, which is, it might not be so much a solipsistic universe as much as everything is pervaded by consciousness and by perhaps a life force or a divine force, however you want to spiritually define it or define yourself. But it's this grand unfolding, this kind of symphony of existence that unfolds constantly. And I don't think that's solipsism as much as kind of a unity of reality. That's a kind of mysticism, and I don't know if that would fit into any of your four guests who spoke about consciousness, but that's my general take.
No, they tried to place it somewhere, and it bothered them that I was suggesting that only one of us was talking. But yeah, I think the most important thing you just said was about the ethical implications of, even if you acknowledged that, because I always thought of it kind of like, you know, you think of the universe tilting in one direction and you hope it's tilting in the good direction. And you, even though you're an infinitesimal part of that, if you're going to live your life, you might as well live it tilting in the right direction too, even though you're really not going to make a difference. It's still the right thing to do.
Especially if you don't know the consequences of your choices.
Yeah, it's heroic, actually, in its own way.
It could be, or it could, you know, or you just might be you're just trying to be in harmony with the good. You know?
Yeah, I have a Buddha nature, but there's two ways of looking at that too. You know, if you meet the Buddha in the road, kill him, you know.
Well, I think what that means is that's just kind of warning to not get too sanctimonious or not to uptight about religion in some ways. I did the launch party. It was yesterday, actually, and I felt like I talked about Buddhism too much, but not particularly coherently. But I'll say, like, one metaphor for talking about Buddhism or even being a Zen teacher or a spiritual teacher that I always enjoyed is, it's like you're selling water next to the river, you know, where, you know, the thing that people need or the thing that people are trying to get, they already have. But you're selling it anyway. And if you're a good teacher, you are enticing them to drink what they already have. But you're kind of being a con artist. And I probably spoke. But anyways, I like that idea of talking about Buddhism.
Yeah, It starts kind of like Colston, Newcastle. And then I saw this cartoon in the New Yorker of a log truck going in one direction on the road and a log truck going in the opposite direction on the road. And it was like, okay, you know, what's the point? You know? Uh-huh. And my favorite Coens are the ones like where someone says, "Master, what's the Buddha nature?" And the master takes a big stick and hits him over the head and says, "That's what it is." Those are my favorite.
Yeah, well, they keep trying to wake us up.
And the other thing before I actually ask you, so I always forget we're trying to sell your book. That's my mistake.
That's okay. That's all right.
But I really like the idea. And this is where I got the solipsism thing from, because I read it and I thought, hey, this is what I would write. And what it was what the idea of two protagonists at a party. And all of a sudden they're in this Sargasso Sea kind of place where one is a plastic bag and the other is this nubbin of a piece of plastic chewed off the end of a baby's pacifier. And I go, yeah, I get it. That's pretty much me. That's pretty much me. But that's pretty weird, right? I mean, you're really weird the way you write. I mean, people don't write like that.
I will accept that statement. I think that first, that prologue is really, you know, just priming the reader to go, we're going to do some different things here. And also those are symbols, each of those like brief, quick incarnations that happen there. They all kind of are emblematic of a crisis we're in, you know, whether it's an environmental crisis or a kind of the commercialization of art or the automation of labor, you know, all those incarnations are kind of pointing to crises we're in. And so I thought it doesn't matter that it's weird that we transform each time. It just matters, does the flow point to something, and is the reader, and also it's priming the reader's expectations for the rest of the ride through the book.
Do you remember, I don't know if you're old enough, do you remember that Bugs Bunny cartoon where there's this big kettle of really hot water and he sticks his toe in it and then he gets a little further in and he thinks it's a really nice bath, but then they're slicing carrots and putting them in the bowl and he's going to be rabbit stew.
Yeah.
He doesn't know it yet. He just thinks he's having a relaxing spa-like day. There's no question. I just...
I remember that cartoon, yeah.
I love that cartoon. So tell... Okay, here, now we're going to, okay, this is the start of selling your book. I could do like Terry Gross and say, tell us a little bit about what your book is about, or just tell us about, just tell us about Frank, who Frank is and why he's here.
The first question, what's the book about, is maybe even slightly easy to answer than who's Frank. Frank is a character who, Frank Exit is a name that appears in every one of my novels, actually. Kind of more prominently in the last one, and then in this one. I wouldn't necessarily say that in each of novels they're the same character. I'll tell you, here's an example of how I maybe think of characters and characterization. And it is what you called it weird, but you know, and it might be weird, but it might be non-traditional. That I got a very nice review actually in the Washington Post, which, and I'm not saying that to pump me up, but it was very moving and sweet to get. I thought it was well-written and it was a personal kind of elegant style. And I love it. I have no complaints about it. Except, and I'll say this, which is not a complaint, but the reviewer got one of the characters' name, took the name of one character and used it and misnamed, and talked about another character using that name, misnamed a character, in other words, was confused. And it didn't bother me at all. And I don't think it's important at all, actually, because for a couple of reasons. One, it's easy to be confused in this book where there's multiple narrators and more than one is unnamed. So having an unnamed narrator in general is confusing, have multiple is very confusing. But also I have the technology of character in novels is usually something where we are invited into a universe and we have to pretend it's real and pretend the voice of the character is real and that personality is something that is static throughout the tale. For me, it really doesn't matter as much. And I think that instead of a character, what we're really using is Harry Matthews. I've never been able to find this quote, but I'm pretty sure Harry Matthews said this. All you need for a character is a name and a haircut. That's all you need to establish, right? And so I feel the same way, except sometimes you change the name, or sometimes you put the name on two different characters, or sometimes they have different haircuts. And so all that's important is that the reader comes along with you, and that understands what's happening, understands that a voice is telling a tale. And maybe they get that personality, that character confused, but it doesn't matter to me as much.
Hey, so you're not a character because you're a name and a hat.
Could be, or, well, the character has to be held consistently for a while, but maybe after that while, then you can pick another name from the hat.
Like the sorting hat.
Like the sorting hat, yeah.
It's interesting that, oh, in the beginning, the robot is named after the guy who writes your epigraph.
That's right. I like that philosophy of that Cesar Ayres' philosophy. This is how he turns out all those books. You know, he sits down at a cafe, he writes for a day, sits down for the next day, and then after he has so many pages, that's a book. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's what he says he does. And if on page 7, the main character is a child who likes ice cream, and then on page 89, that all of a sudden that same character is a woman who's a nun, he goes with it. He doesn't necessarily feel constrained by ideas of fictional continuity.
Well, that goes like what I said at the beginning. Well, that's the other thing, you know, you have a cover, a title, another title, a prologue to the prologue, a prologue, and then we get to read the book. So, but the thing about it at the end of the second title is flux. And flux is change and flow, but it has this other connotation of like mercury, like something that's, I can't explain it. But why is it so important? Why do you even choose to use, yeah, flux?
I think because everything is change, and that's all we have. the flux is in a way presented as a synonym for the winds of la huida hacia adelante, that escape tumbling forward. It's described as made equal to the unfolding of events in front of us, and or the change, the continuous change, or the flux. So that's why I think it's kind of a central ground. It's the only real, maybe it's not the only, but it's a primary truth that what we have is change. What we are is change. What is change.
Right. And that's what governs the whole space-time continuum, actually. Yeah, Richard Feynman said with somebody else, I think it was Wheeler, that they posited that there's only one electron in the universe. Because they're all fungible. There's no difference between any electron, and that there's only one electron, and it just keeps going back and forth, and that creates our universe, and it just keeps going faster and faster and farther and farther. So it's not like the universe is 13.2 billion years old. It's sextillion billion years old, and we're just that one electron at that one time, and then it completely changes. Once again, no question.
There's this, I'll answer your non-question with a non-answer. There's this, I forget, there's some cartoon, but it's a graph. Maybe you've seen it. It says, and it's an XY graph, and up this way is here's how it's plotted. It goes, not as your knowledge of physics rises, your knowledge of the universe also rises, except some point your knowledge of physics is very high, and then your knowledge of the universe drops to almost nothing, because then it could just get bizarre and confusing.
I know. Do you know how the Dalai Lama meets or did meet every year with the quantum physicists? And each year they met, they got closer and closer to an understanding of what was going on.
I've heard stories like that, yes.
Yeah, it's cool. Well, so anyway, we never got... Okay, so Frank is this dog who's the reincarnation of a dead guy. So let's start there.
Frank Exit is a character who decides to who kills himself. And the bulk of the book is friends remembering Frank, changed by Frank's death, and or one particular grief-stricken person who goes on a kind of a wild goose chase, wild dog chase, where because he has become, the unnamed narrator has become convinced that this dog, this robot dog, is a reincarnation of their dead friend, deceased friend. Whereas the book tries to say, there's an alternate explanation where it's not really the reincarnation of the dead friend, but it is an AI which is capable of making the bereaved think that they're talking to their lost loved one. So that's the general plot of that thread that runs through the book.
How come you, when she goes to steal Frank back, so the little girl comes out and she, rather than attempting to confront her about Frank or about what she might be doing in the kitchen, she decides she's going to give a kind of dissertation on her perception of art and her disillusionment. And then the woman just kind of makes fun of her and punches her in the stomach, which is always a good way to kind of like get what you want, because you really can't recover from that quickly. But where the hell does that come from? I mean, seriously, you're just sitting there and you go, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
I think there's a lot of genre influence in the book, right? And what meaning, there's chase scenes, there are detectives tropes or action adventure movie things. And here's how that kind of stuff will come out. You know, the scene is going to have to do something. And you figure, okay, the character has to steal the dog or run away with the dog. Maybe there'll be a confrontation. But if you were just trying to move this story forward and have your characters kind of move forward in whatever plot you're creating, it's kind of work. You know, it's work getting the characters to align themselves with your story. For whatever reason, I'm not particularly fond of that kind of work, but I do like writing a lot. So I'll come to the notebook, I'll come on that day's writing session. I'll know, you know what the block has to do, you know what the frame story has to do. But you also, I find, you allow yourself all the freedom of improvisation that you want. So how I used to describe it is, we live through all kinds of narratives. You've named a bunch already, the narratives of physics, but you wake up, you hear a story on the radio, you read a book on your commute, read a magazine story from the New Yorker on your lunch break, you watch a science fiction movie with your kid, or you read them in children's books. Anyways, we pick up and we put down those narratives all the time. And my original description of the structure, the structures that maybe are feel a bit weird, were that to replicate kind of that passing through narratives that we have in our daily lives so easily. But I think that explanation was partly true, partly a justification. What I really do, or what really drives that those unexpected turns is what I said before. You set up the frame story, or you set up where you want the scene to go, or where you need to vaguely know that the scene has to go, but you give yourself all the license in the world. That's what Cesar Ira does for himself. And that gives you the chance to improvise. And I think, like in conversations, improvisation, I mean, not sticking to a script, is kind of the funnest part. So in that sense, that's where the things arise, because you've given yourself license to do it. Why then these particular themes come up? Well, those are the habits of mind that I've developed, or those are the obsessions that I have. And so it's nice to be able to express them within these improvisations.
As an aside, who is that semi-sentient creature that's wandering around behind you?
He's named Louie. I hope you're talking about my cat.
It wasn't you. Sorry.
His first name, if there is a cat wandering around, his first name is Louie, and his second name is also Louie. He's Louie Louie.
Like the song?
Like the song.
So yeah, like what you're talking about, I mean, okay, so how did you decide to pick a picture of Pat Morita out of, you know, Happy Days? What, you know, how did you decide that? And where did you find it? And then Yeah.
Okay, so Pat Morita is a major presence in the book, actually. There's a lot of reasons that Pat Morita is in the book, but one of the reasons is there's also a discussion about authenticity and identity. At Inauthentic Sushi, the friends talk about different Asian American comedians and the different ways that they have had to modify their acts or realize that their acts are to a white audience or to a dominant culture audience, and they have by necessity changed their act to, in some ways, cater to another audience, an audience that doesn't look like them. And this is, I think, is historically true. And there's so few really Asian American comedians or that made it, and even Asian American actors really until very recently. And why do they do it? Why do they put themselves there? Because they love the art form. And Pat Morita had a really tragic life. He was born to Japanese immigrants, and he had this weird injury as a child, and he got this tuberculosis, and he was bedridden for 7 or 8 years, maybe more. Then there was this miraculous surgery, and he was able to walk. But the war had started, World War II had started, so he was able to walk, and as soon as he was able to walk, they led him to the internment camps. And then his father got hit in an accident. His mother might not have been his mother. And he had all, but through it, but he really wanted to be a performer. Anyways, Pat Morita's story, I think, is very interesting. And the clown chapter is basically a disguised, embedded mini biography of Pat Morita. And so I think I include him because, for a lot of reasons, but one, to talk about the difficulty to be authentic, or the difficulty to be a Asian American performer, comedian, writer within a hegemonic space, a space that is different from your own, or has a audience which comes from a culture which is somewhat at odds with the one your family might have.
Yeah, and I understand and appreciate it, his presence, as well as the presence of, say, Spike Lee or In Living Color. What's the guy's name that I've forgotten his name? In Living Color.
Which one? Steve Park?
Yeah. He was funny. That was a great show. That was a great show, way ahead of its time. The Wayans brothers. Yeah, so Spike Lee In Living Color. But then it's not like Ransom Riggs when he writes Miss Peregrine stuff, because he goes around looking for picture postcards, and then that drives the plot. These kids look like the powers he wants to give them. But why do you choose, I don't want to beat a dead horse or drag it out, but why do you choose to say, okay, this chapter will resonate and will replicate to a certain extent his life, but I'm also going to choose to put a photograph of him? Because people don't, I mean, that's not done very often.
The photograph is interesting because the photograph is for multiple reasons too. There's a photograph of some eyes in the beginning of the book. And there's a quote from Sebald. In Sebald's Austerlitz, he has a photograph of, I think it's Wittgenstein's eyes. And he has a quote about comparing the wide-eyed philosopher's gaze to these owls or these animals in some kind of zoo or some kind of nocturnal situation, about peering into, I forget what the metaphor is, but peering into, or gazing into the truth, wide-eyed. And he makes this kind of romantic gesture or this vision of the philosopher with their big eyes. And of course, well, I just thought that's a kind of eye-shaped bias, if you want to call it. And so I thought I would make a joke about that and include in the beginning a photograph of Pat Morita's eyes as a young comic from a headshot where he called himself, self-titled himself, or it was self-billed, the Hip Nip. You know, it was kind of almost taking this derogatory euphemism, this racial epithet, and recasting it, making fun of himself. So I think all those things kind of pointed to the same theme and allowed myself to include him in it.
Did you ever read this book called Wittgenstein's Poker?
No, I've read Wittgenstein's Nephew and I've read Wittgenstein's Mistress, but I have not read Wittgenstein's
poker. He got to a fight with some other philosopher and he took the poker out of the fireplace and hit the guy over the head.
He had a bad temper, Wittgenstein. I remember he wanted, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it reminded me of her punching the girl in the stomach.
Wittgenstein, did you read Ray Monk's biography of Wittgenstein? It's a fun one. And I remember there was a scene where, or maybe this is a famous thing about him. He had these ideals. He wanted to go teach school children, right? And give up being a philosopher. So he does it. He goes and, but they wouldn't listen. So he had to box them, you know, across the ears. And that made him confused and they didn't know what to do. So,
yeah.
So the philosopher is not they don't have the whole market cornered on ethical behavior.
No, it's like when Larry David was a stand-up comedian, he would go out in the audience and start and they wouldn't laugh and he'd go, ah, you guys aren't worth it, fuck you. And he just walks off the stage.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of attitude, you know? Yeah, so I was gonna ask you. So when you say at the beginning, you allow us, I mean, usually when I'm talking to an author, I say, okay, when you let this book out, is it like letting your firstborn out? And are you afraid the readers are gonna, you know, take it and go someplace you don't want them to go? But you're saying at the outset, which most people don't say, is that it's the reader's adventure. And you don't wrap the book up in paper, brown paper and twine at the end. So we're free to go. I mean, we're free to do whatever we want, right? In all your works.
Well, I have no control of what the reader does. But
no.
But that beginning is more about, that's the reader's adventure. That's your adventure as the avid reader. Do you not, over these all these books that you've read and all these, maybe all these author interviews, but all these books you're reading, you know, in a way, maybe in the beginning, maybe still, you're always searching for the next book. I don't know if this is true for you, but when you're between books and you don't know what the next one's going to be, there's a certain homeless feeling, right? Like, what am I going to do next? Or, and you cast around for the right book. That's the adventure of the reader, right? And that's what that is alluding to. And it's alluding to that sensation married with the fact that we have an infinite library now. I mean, we can almost get any book that you want. So that's the adventure of the reader. That's also the Library of Babel. You have all possibilities. Now go. now what are you gonna do with all these possibilities? So that's the adventure of the reader. And I think what the beginning of the book does and what I hope it does and what I think good non-traditional books do or you know weird books can do is they can teach you how to read them as you're reading.
Yeah, and that goes to your third epigraph from Fran Lebowitz where she says the closest thing she can come to a person is a book. And yeah, also
go ahead. That's also part of that weird like what is an AI? I mean like what makes a consciousness, right? A book is a real, real close to a person. I mean, when she says that, you get it, right? It's a capturing of a person's like, you know, thoughts and soul and whatever. So it goes back to AI, but it's also, yeah, that's what we're looking for.
When I read that epigraph, it reminded me of what Groucho said, which was
outside.
Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
Yeah.
I don't know why that came into my head when I read that, but I always love that.
It's a good dog and reading joke. That's why.
The funniest cartoons in the New Yorker are always about dogs, invariably. The best one recently was the one where the cop pulls the dog over and he goes, "Do you know why I stopped you?" "Yes, you do. Yes, you do." That's funny. Well, so this is what I do. I end up doing all the talking. It's really irritating.
Okay. I'm enjoying it.
Well, so if you know, it's funny because at the bookstore, you're right. Every day someone comes in and I say, do you ever read on your iPad or your Kindle? And they go, no, I like holding the author. They say it. I like holding the author in my hand. So I was just thinking, I never thought of it before, but it is pretty close to AI. It really is.
I joke with the kids. I say this is, well, anyways, I find that it's true. I find that when you pick up a book, you are, and I think writers try to, you know, they did all those phrases like, I'm naked on the page, or I put my whole self into it, or, you know, those are description of someone, of It's an extended act of expressing something. And so if you go flip back to that AI question, the AI which are consuming the entire internet, all of our speech and thought and all of our words, that's a pretty interesting meal then, if you think about it also, coupled with that idea, you're holding the author in your hand, right? Yeah. Those two things, if you put them together, that's a weird conflation or a weird sum.
And like, if you think about what you were saying about me, you know, having interviewed over 700 authors now, including like Paul Harding and Isabel Allende and David Mitchell 3 or 4 times. And, you know, it's like, I'm so lucky. It's like Christmas morning talking to these people. It's like, you know, don't you feel like, see, since you don't own a bookstore, it's hard, but I still want books for presents, but no one knows what to get me. Yeah. So I always find me a book that I have no idea that exists. But isn't it? And I always wrap them in brown paper and twine because I think that's the way a book should be sold. There's no other way you could possibly sell a book. And isn't it like Christmas morning, like when you open one, that you don't know what it is?
Yeah. I think in some ways, being a librarian, maybe it's true of being a bookstore, is you do, even though there's something that you get, you take books for granted because they're so around you, someone. I try not to. It sounds like you do not, but sometimes, especially when there's a flood of bad books. But the other, to go back to that idea of the adventure of the reader, or you, it's Christmas every morning or something like that, the good book is rare. And I mean, the good book is on one sense not rare. A good read is not rare, but like the wildly life-changing book is rare, I think, unless you're special perhaps. And that keeps you hunting, you know, it keeps you looking, it keeps you in the search.
It's funny because there's the bookends of the customers I have, or some kid, this kid came in, he was 12 years old, and he came up and he had War and Peace. And I couldn't charge him for that. It was like, it's not like I'm a great guy. It's just that, how could you charge a kid for buying War and Peace? And then there was some other guy, he walks around for 40 minutes in there, and then he walks out and I go, what's the deal? And he goes, well, I didn't see anything that interested me. I'm going, what the hell's wrong with you? I mean, I go into the bookstore sometime. If I like the bookstore, I'll buy books that I already know I have.
Yeah. Bookstores are very difficult places to go sometimes.
You know? I know.
I mean, I you probably have the same problem. It gets to be a storage issue.
I just moved 150 banker's boxes of books to this house and I have no idea. Books are heavy too. Talk about moving mass. That's all it is just moving mass. So I have 150 boxes to go through. And yeah, it's a very strange.
Did you watch that documentary that the Fran Lebowitz thing is from, The Booksellers?
Yeah. Yeah. And he goes, why do you do this? And he goes, well, what else would you do?
Yeah. I like those people who have the professions where they had no choice. They don't have they couldn't do anything else.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's like sometimes you can't help it. Like my vet was named Dr. Fox. You know, I thought, well, and unfortunately, which is off colors, my ex-wife's gynecologist was named Dr. Menzies.
So, not as good a joke, but my kid's pediatrician is Dr. Hate, H-A-T-E, and our dentist for a while was Dr. Love. So I thought that was pretty good.
Dr. Love. Yeah, that is pretty good. Another bookend. Yeah, my most favorite thing is, well, you know, if bookstores are cool because you walk in, it smells a certain way. I have library ladders, which is great. But the cool thing is if someone's looking for a book, they go up the library ladder, there's the book. But unlike Amazon giving you recommendations, you're seeing the book on either side of the book that you're looking for. And one of those could easily be like Sophie's Choice or something like that. That's the book that's going to change your life. Yeah. That's the coolest thing.
Absolutely. That's why the library is not infinite in that sense. It kind of projects the infinite possibilities, but it is the happenstance of that shelf and who created that shelf, who chose those books there, and your luck in being there at that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. It actually is a lot like Borges, about how those blasphemers come and take out the books they don't think are good, you know. Yeah. But, you know, the other, you know, in addition to, you know, in the reviews talking about Borges, it also reminded me of, and I'm not trying to flatter you, but it reminded me a lot of Ulysses, James Joyce Ulysses, because it's just, you know, one day and he's just walking around, you know, and because he's just thinking, there's all these things that just like when everybody thinks, you know, whether it's Mrs. Dalloway or whatever, it goes exactly like your book, right? It's just like, yeah, she's talking about art when she's coming to steal her dog. Well, why not? I'm saying to you, why would you do such a thing? But then that's what I do all the time, right? And you too.
Yeah. Well, that, I'm reminded of the Joyce joke. Someone says to Joyce, your book is trivial. He says, yes, and quadrivial. You know, he multiplies the trivia. He multiplies all the references. So he didn't think of that as a put down. Your book is trivial. He thought of it, yes, but it takes trivia and does it, multiplies it by it one more time.
Yeah, it's like when he says, I don't ask much of my reader. I just ask them to devote the rest of their life to trying to interpret my books. Yeah, it's like that. But so I guess to conclude, why are you a librarian and why are you still a librarian? Because that's what this is all about.
Why do you run your bookstore?
I know why. You answer me first.
Okay. Initially, I'm a librarian because I thought it was a good job for a writer. An experimental writer. Well, anyways, it's a good job for a writer. It's a little bit different from being a teacher because you don't have to grade anything. But you still, if you work like I do in a high school library, you get some time off during the summer. And I don't really necessarily like the institution. Like, I'm not that against Mark Twain's phrase, I never let my schooling get in the way of my education. And I think that in some ways, the school library can be kind of this anarchistic force within the institution that is trying to produce these citizens. So that's one reason. The other reason is I like the idea and symbol of libraries. And my particular school, the kids are engaged, curious, and give me hope. So I like my gig in that sense too.
It's funny because, you know, I've been a builder, I've been a lawyer, kind of a writer. And it's funny because when I first opened the bookstore, I kind of got embarrassed because it was like, I'm just a bookseller. And then I thought, everyone who comes into the bookstore, whether just for the cafe or whatever, they're happy. They get happy. And I thought, what could you do that would be better than that? So whenever I think, I'm just this or just that, I just realize, okay, if you get up in the morning and your job is to make people happy, what else could you do that would be better than that?
Seems like a good line of argument to me.
Yeah. Well, okay. Once again, as with all my authors, David Mitchell tells me I did most of the talking, but I hope at least you felt like you got your book out there somewhat, because that's what this is about.
I had a fun time talking with you.
Yeah. And lastly, I guess, okay, so it'll be on the front table. It is now. It's on the front table, be in the window. But last question. And this is what happens when I talk to an author that says, my book is not YA, don't put it in YA. Your book is not science fiction, but some people, well, it's, there's a review in that fantasy fiction thing on the net, and it's not science fiction, it's speculative. So where are my bookstore? What section? There you go. Last question. What section do I put it in?
I think you should put it in the front, and you should build like big Ziggler, big pyramids of the book. Well, you know, there's the question of what different sections or ghettos of books do you have? But I don't mind being in the science fiction section. I certainly don't mind being in the literature section. I think that like sometimes I worry that the books are marketed as kind of sci-fi romps, science fiction romps, and they might disappoint the reader who's looking for a space opera or a science fiction plot-driven story. But I also know that science fiction readers are incredibly curious and smart, and they have kind of an elastic idea of what a story is, trained because of this, I think, all the play of ideas that go into speculative fiction, science fiction. So I have no problems being there. I was initially, after I was told that I was a science fiction writer, a little bit, I thought, not really, it's not me. But I've come to be totally fine and happy and pleased with that designation.
I know, and it's wonderful that, you know, we all read Ray Bradbury and Theodore Sturgeon and Robert Heinlein and all that, but it's a different world. They wrote about a certain world, and it was whatever you want to call it, space opera or science fiction, but now it's not the same, and it should have another word. Speculative is one, but...
I remember Steve Erickson. Some review said Steve Erickson is science fiction without the science, right? Part. And it's not really true, but Steve Erickson is a kind of similar writer in that it's vaguely speculative. There are no lasers, there are no robots, there are no space travel. There's some weird events that happen sometimes. And it often is a projection of the future. So if I'm in Steve Erickson's company, I'm totally happy.
Yeah, it's like magical realism. Sometimes I ask an author if it's magical realism, they get upset, and sometimes they embrace it.
I think that if you said I was magical realist, I'd be a little bit more perturbed with science fiction, but I'm okay with science fiction.
That's so funny. Okay, well, Eugene, it was a pleasure talking to you. And like I said, it's in the front, and maybe I think you were going to say a ziggurat. Maybe I'll do it with that. But it's harder. It's harder to, pyramid's easier to arrange, I think. And kids won't knock it over as easily.
Yeah, I have not attempted, so you can report back, see how it goes.
You have enough copies that you can, do that.
I'll think about that.
Okay. I look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for talking with me. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Bye-bye.